We're coming now in the weekly order of reading through the Torah to the end of a sequence which begins the process of leaving Egypt, leaving Mitzrayim, and achieving the status of being what the Jewish people is or are, and culminating in the construction of the Mishkan. The Mishkan, which in English is known as the sanctuary or the tabernacle. The Mishkan, that forerunner of the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, which was the tent of meeting or the place of meeting where the Jewish people met and made contact with the divine emanation, the Shekhinah. This structure, this tent of intimate meeting, there's very many secrets that are hidden in this area, this part of Torah. Let's see if we can try to reach for one of the deepest elements, which needs a lot of thinking and a lot of working out, and let's see if we can bring it down into a practical application. Let's try and start at the higher level, the point of origin, if you like, strictly speaking, ideas that are beyond us, the source of these ideas even forbidden to us to think about for various reasons. But let's see if we can at least begin with a higher point of contact and then try to bring it down to practical application. So we'll need a number of layers, and we'll need to work through the layers. Let's try and do that carefully. First of all, apart from many other secrets that are taught in the construction and in the nature of the layout and the anatomy, if you like, of this building, this Mishkan, which is parallel to the construction of the world, and it's parallel to the human being, and it's parallel to the human mind. It's a microcosm, if you like, a diagram, or it's a structure or a model, if you like, but it's much more than a model. But it's a projection of the structure of the world. And the world itself is a projection of a structure that is human in its nature and its shape and form. It's a microcosm of the human and of the universe. But one specific facet and one specific message of this building that accompanies the Jewish people through their wanderings through the desert and ultimately accompanies us always, whether it's in a hidden form, buried, and out of contact with us now as it is now, or in temple times when it manifests as the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, or will in the Messianic age, one of the functions and one of the aspects that this structure models is the Jewish heart, Jewish neshama, the human heart at a broader level, the human consciousness, but the Jewish people and the individual Jewish consciousness. And perhaps this evening we could try to work out one theme only. There are many, many themes here. Obviously, if we're talking about a microcosm of that which is universal, we'll find all the themes here meeting. But let's try to define for ourselves one particular element that is an essential in terms of building the character that we can learn from this parsha, this area. And the source of this in its general terms is that when the Torah expresses the idea, the commandment, to build this Mishkan, the sanctuary, the way it's phrased is, Vasuli Mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, Vashachanti Betocham, and I will dwell within them. So the sages, commentaries with their super conscious ears, they pick up that the grammar doesn't follow. It's apparent on examining the syntax that there's something that doesn't follow. If it says, make for me a sanctuary, the second part of the verse should say, and I shall dwell within it. But it doesn't say that. It says, I'll dwell within them. So loosely translated, the way Torah should never be loosely translated, it means, make for me a sanctuary, and since the Mishkan is within you, when I dwell there, I'll be dwelling among you. But the accurate translation, and this is again what our commentaries point out, is, that when you make me a sanctuary, when you make yourselves, elevate yourselves and open yourself to that higher dimension, and you do that correctly, then I shall dwell within them. That means every Jew. Means that the building of this Mishkan is a sanctuary within which Hashem resides. But the deeper level here, and possibly the more important one to us, certainly in this context, this evening's discussion, is that when that's done correctly, it's really a model or microcosm of the universe that's contained within each individual mind, neshama, heart, consciousness, and therefore there's that ultimate, almost impossible to say the words, but it means that there's a dwelling of that which is infinite within the particulate and individual human neshama. That's what it says, that's what the words say. Now what does that mean? What is the sanctuary within? What is this Mishkan, this inner sanctum that can be built within the Jewish mind? What is that? At a larger level, it's built in the Jewish marriage, very specifically. And everything we say this evening is really, can project itself into not one person, but two in the context of marriage. Very specifically, if we have time, perhaps we can try and work that out in a bit more detail. And it carries beyond that into a family unit and many, many concentric levels here. But let's try to fill out or flesh out at least the personal level, see how far we can get with that. You know, in Jewish thought, we don't have sort of general, vague ideas that the Jewish heart is a sanctuary and, you know, it has holiness. These things are very specific, right? The Torah is... It's the energy that builds every detail in the world, and therefore we need to seek more specifically and more deeply than sort of general notion of holiness or elevation. We need to look for specifics. And let's see if we can try and tease out that theme. But let's backtrack. Let's try and take it to its highest source, at least as high as we're allowed to talk in this context. And then let's try and focus that light onto a very specific area in human development. This building of the Mishkan, let's try and build it in a structured fashion. This building of the Mishkan is subject to an argument. That means the sources that talk about its construction, the command to build the Mishkan, there's a classic argument among our early authorities, time of the Rishonim, 800, 900, 1,000 years ago. There's a fundamental argument about the nature of that commandment, right? Let's follow it through carefully. One set of commentaries, namely the Ramban, and backed up actually by the Zohar, which is a much older source, central Kabbalistic work, they express the notion that this Mishkan, this sanctuary, which is the heart of the Jewish camp and the Jewish people, the commandment to build it was issued, was a primary. In other words, it was issued before the sin of the golden calf. It was not a response to a sin or a breakdown. It was primary. In fact, the Ramban says, and it's a classic and well-known piece, that this building of the sanctuary was nothing other than the culmination of the going out of Egypt. You know, the parshas that we're reading now, what we call Shevavim Tat, right? These parshas, which are a very special time of correction of particular areas of the human character, this is the final, this week, last week, and this week are the final point in that building. The Ramban says that the going out of Egypt was not complete with the Exodus, and not complete, in fact, with the splitting of the sea, and not complete even with the giving of the Torah, but only when the whole thing was brought to dwell in a home, right, like man and wife, Hashem and us, as it were, symbolized by the two golden kruvim, two golden angelic forms that were formed from one piece of gold that stood atop the aron in which the tablets were kept, and later the Sefer Torah. From within that intimate meeting, all the sources are clear that they were the form of male and female, and there was an intense relationship between them. In fact, it's well known, and Nefesh HaChaim works this out, and our classic sources indicate that they faced each other, but when our relationship with Hashem was not what it should be, they miraculously turned away from each other. In other words, they were literally a reflection, an embodiment of the relationship between us and Hashem. These two golden kruvim, which were in the inner sanctum of this Mishkan. That was the culmination of the whole process. The coming into being of the Jewish people. They're being taken out of Egypt. They're being uplifted, given the Torah. There was a culmination of all of that, which was even higher, which was the moment when it was all brought home, so to speak, into a dwelling. There are other commentaries who take a completely different view. Sforna, for example, Rashi goes according to this, not based on the chronology of the verses, because in the Torah we don't necessarily have things reported in their chronological sequence, right? They don't. And they point out, according to their view, that the building of the Mishkan, the command to build the Mishkan was given after the sin of the golden calf. Now the sin of the golden calf was the fall from the status of an intimate relationship with Hashem into its opposite, right? The nature of that sin in essence is idolatry. That means making a golden image. Now you have to understand here, we're talking about a golden image that was worshipped in an idolatrous fashion. Again, this needs to be understood very deeply at the level of the people. This is not, these were people who spoke to Hashem one day. They didn't turn the next day and worship a lump of gold. In a simple sense, it has to be understood deeply. But at their level, nevertheless, this was a... And the Mishkan that was built also had golden image or images inside. Now, there's a counterpart here that needs to be followed through. But this image that they created and worshipped, there was a fall into a situation of idolatry. And after that sin, which broke the relationship with us, between us and Hashem, then was the commandment given to build the Mishkan, which was a symptom of the breakdown and a cause of its correction. We have a deep idea in Jewish thinking, fundamental idea at the deepest level, that every situation of a problem is deeply its own correction. There's not time now to work it out in detail, but we have a concept that the world's built in such a way that every element of breakdown brings about its own correction. Self-correcting system where, I mean, the classic application, again, now's not the time to go into it, but the classic application is that an action that's done wrongly in the world, right, in our very what we call a sin, generates its own damage in the world. The damage is the punishment, it is the pain, and the pain is the resensitization or the correction of the neshama, bringing it back to its perfection. Which means that you can reach your ultimate perfection either through doing what you have to do or through doing what you shouldn't do. Doing it through the way you should is building and sensitizing your neshama, and lifting yourself to where you should be lifted to. Doing it the wrong way is setting up a damage in the world. The damage you will have to feel, because it is set up within you, and that damage becomes the pain that you live through, which is ultimately its own correction. That's how the world is set up. You realize deeply that this is a guarantee of perfection. The world is set up with a guarantee of its ultimate perfection. So either you build it, or else you're forced to build it. There's such an idea. These opinions hold that the building of the Mishkan was a response to a sin, to a negative, to a broken down situation. Right? It was given after the situation of sin. Therefore, it is an outcome, a product of that fall, that schism in the relationship between us and Hashem. And of course, it is the methodology of its correction. It's taking the golden image that was wrongly built and worshipped, in disparity, in breakdown of our relationship with Him, and it's building a sanctuary in which there is again a golden image, but correctly done this time, in which the relationship is re-manifest. It is a relationship, it is the two of them. There's a mystical idea that's brought that the voice of Hashem spoke from between the two. That means from within this relationship of these two golden images, His voice spoke from to us. Our relationship with Him was manifest within that relationship of these things. Well, no, the Gemara says clearly that when the Romans destroyed the second temple, these two golden angels were dragged through the streets by the Romans. In fact, it was not the original ones, the ones that were built later, but that's not... The point is that they were dragged through the streets, and it's well known, the Talmud itself deals with this, the sources deal with it, is that at the time of the destruction, when the Romans mocked the Jews, they dragged these things, these golden kruvim, through the streets in order to imply that this is what the Jewish people in the inner sanctum, for all their talk about the oneness, the transcendent oneness of Hashem, this is really what they worship. And one of the mysteries is that the two kruvim that were dragged through the streets then were locked in an embrace of love. And the paradox, of course, is if it was the moment of destruction, there could be no moments of greater separation between us and Hashem. If there's one time when they should have been turned completely away from each other, that it is that moment. And yet when they were exposed to public view, they were locked in an embrace with each other. There are many meanings to this, including the one we've just been through about a situation of destruction being its own correction. But at least one of the ideas here is that these two angels were turned away from each other. But that's in terms of our relationship with Hashem, where they're exposed to non-Jewish eyes. And so even this moment, then when the scale of relativity, as it were, when the relevant scale of frame of reference is the non-Jewish world, when it's exposed there and not in the private inner sanctum of our relationship, so then what looks like destruction, yes, of our temple and our breakdown with our, you know, with our Creator, but relative to the non-Jewish world, yes, relative to them, this is a moment of tremendous intensity. There's many more layers here, but That means when two people love each other and there's a moment of friction between them and a moment of tremendous friction between them, and a bystander happening in on the discussion would feel tremendous friction and enmity. Right? But what that bystander wouldn't realize is that the pain here is being felt because of the love between these two individuals. Right? That means this person standing on the outside is not even part of the relationship. This person who may be mocking and pointing out the friction here that's taking place between the two who love each other, right, is correct that there's a friction, but it's a friction in the context of how much they mean to each other, and that's why this situation is taking place. This person who's just stepped in is nothing, nobody, no relationship at all. So what do we have? We have two opinions. One opinion is that the commandment to build the Mishkan was a primary issue. It was done. That's the way it had to be. It was the culmination of the going out of Egypt. Things had to be that way. Just perfect. The second opinion is completely at variance. That it was only due to the breakdown, so to speak, because of the sin, because of a fracture in our relationship, that there was a commandment to build this as a symptom, manifestation of the problem, and a methodology of correction. Now, can these two be reconciled, these two views? There is an opinion, very beautiful opinion, in one of the later masters, not that long ago, who puts it together in a way that is very important for us to understand in terms of the subject we're trying to develop together this evening. And he says this. Now, this requires thought, and we're going to get here into the world of paradox, which will take us to the deepest realms or reaches of the creation and before the creation. But we need to go through this, because when we come to apply it to our own neshamas, we're going to have to find this within ourselves. And the idea is this. The method of reconciling, the pathway of reconciling these two opinions is something like this. Now, we're dealing with two opposites, remember. We're dealing with the situation of the creation of a Mishkan that was primary and had to be that way, and an opinion that this was a non-ideal situation, the result of breakdown. So let's backtrack a little bit and see if we can try and put this together. There are a lot of elements to draw together here. Let's do our best. Now, these words are dangerous, and we're treading here on territory that's, if misunderstood, is extremely, extremely dangerous. But the problem is as follows. Try and pick our way very, very cautiously here, not use words that are forbidden. The problem here is that you're talking about a building, which is a very small, finite space. The Mishkan was very small, much smaller than the temple that was built later, and much smaller than the second temple, which was twice the size of the first. So in a tiny tent of meeting, skins, small space. And within that space, the Creator manifests to the human being. You're talking about that which is the manifestation of ultimate oneness, right? Which occupies not only the whole world, but is all that exists, is existence. And somehow that's manifesting in a tiny space. That's an immense problem. The source of this problem is well beyond what we're allowed to think of. There's a lot written about this in the deeper sources. Completely off limits. Many layers below this are off limits. But we can talk about it here in this application. When our minds wander to the source of this paradox, one needs control, not to think about those things. There's a prohibition to think. The Gemara says that it's prohibited to think what's before and what's after, what's above and what's below. To think beyond a certain point is forbidden, because at that point there can be no productive thought. You move into a world that transcends the individual existence of the one who's thinking. And therefore you can only get it wrong. It's well known. The one, Reb Chaim Volozhin, it's well known. Reb Chaim Volozhin, the star pupil of the Gaon of Vilna. And he was once in conversation with his Rebbe, the Gaon of Vilna, taught us many of these things, or opened them up to us. And the Gaon of Vilna said something. He must have said something, or somewhere in the discussion arose, God must have mentioned something about his own Yetzer Hara. His own evil inclination, his own lower side, his own lower self. And when this mention came up, Reb Chaim Volozhin, the ultimate pupil, the ultimate Talmud, the disciple, he must have emitted a broken sigh and said something like, if only my Yetzer Tov was like your Yetzer Hara. In other words, the respect for his Rebbe and the great man that he was expressed the idea that if only the best of him would be as high as the lowest. And the lowest side of the Gaon, it would be a tremendous elevation for him. So the Gaon upbraided him. The Gaon said to him, you have no idea how powerful my Yetzer Hara is. You aspire to elevate yourself to the point of my negativity. You have no idea how negative my negativity is. And then he explained. He said, you know what my Yetzer Hara is? You know what my illicit drive is and my lust is? It's to think what's above and what's below and what's in front and what's behind. That means I'm driven by a craving to think into a world that we're forbidden to think in. I heard once from a very great man the inner meaning of this, which is a remarkable insight, because at face value, what is the story saying? At face value, yes, somebody with an insensitive ear will get exactly the wrong message. What is the Gaon of Vilna saying? I'm so holy. Yes, that I'm so holy that my greatest lust and craving is to think of even more holiness. That in fact is something to us. Yeah, that's going to put Reb Chaim off. After he hears that, he's going to crave even more that his ultimate greatness should be as high as the Gaon. But you know what the Gaon of Vilna meant? He meant that in my craving, in my desire to think of those things, do you know what transgression that constitutes? Idolatry. Because to think of the things that you can't think about, what will you conclude? When you think into areas that are beyond human contemplation. So what you'll grasp, there will be something that is a reduction. And by definition, at that level, that will be the source of bringing the ultimate and infinite oneness down into something less than what it is. Isn't that the source of idolatry? So let us be cautious as we enter this area. In our terms, the terms we can consider, we're dealing here with a sanctuary, a space that is very small, and within it an even smaller sanctum, and within that a very tiny 1 or 2 cubits measurement from within which Hashem's presence manifests. In fact, there's an idea that manifest presence that spoke to us from there was nothing less than Sinai. Sinai itself was that miracle, that the infinite presence of Hashem, who is everything, appeared on a mountain. In some way, that is what we would call a meeting of the infinite with the finite, which is impossible, but it happened. That's our tradition. We begin from an impossible moment. We became the Jewish people in a moment of impossibility, when the infinite creator, who is everything that there is, appeared on a specific mountain, in a specific focus in time and place. That experience of Sinai is transplanted into what the Mishkan is. And the problem is, how does all of existence, and the source of all existence, how does it condense itself? You hear the problem? Again, without thinking beyond where we're allowed to think, but just in this one manifestation. How does it contract itself down, as it were, and limit itself and appear in one place? And the way it's put in technical sources is, we have what's called Malay Chola Aretz Kavoida. The whole world is full of his... And it doesn't just mean that in every part of the world is to be found his glory. It means it is him. Right? The way the Zohar puts it is, Leis Asa Ponomine. There's no place that's free, that's not permeated, saturated with his existence. Right? We say it in common language. You say, Ein Oid Milbal, there's nothing besides him. There's nothing besides him. That's our deepest axiom. That's what Shema means. When we say Echad, we don't mean he's one and not two. We mean much more than that. We mean he's one and there isn't anything else. Never mind another God. There isn't two-ness. There isn't anything. There is only him. So that's the deepest Jewish axiom. If that's our creed and our statement of faith, then how does that manifest in a tiny space? Now, let's go back to our two opinions and see if we can reconcile them. The easy one to see is this process being a result of breakdown. This contraction, this focusing down to a narrow zone, is a result of the fact that we broke the relationship. So that universal manifestation at the highest moment of Sinai, for example, that our sources say that the voice spoke from everywhere. It didn't only speak from Sinai, it spoke from everywhere. That means every part of the creation voiced that voice. That's the concept we would have of Hashem manifesting somehow in some incredible way. But because we broke that down, we shrank things, we fragmented things, we made things particulate and differentiated and broken down. So now the voice is contained from within a tiny space. What about the other opinion? What about the opinion that holds that this focusing down to a narrow zone was the way things were meant to be? That this was the way things were designed before there was a crash and a breakdown? So the sources say something like this. Again, very, very hard to grasp. But let's try at least to get a feel. This, according to our deepest tradition, is something that you can only have. Of these things, you can have only have a yediyah, but not a hasaga. Yediyah means you can know the words, but you can't grasp what they mean. But nevertheless, it's tremendously elevating to reach for what we can grasp in these areas. Just the suggestion of what we can grasp. The nature of that condensation was meant to teach universality. It was meant to be a condensation that carried all of everything within it. That wouldn't have been a shrinking. Now, the way the is trying to understand this, the way the Mishkan was designed to be, before the breakdown, before the fall, was meant to be a focus of creation that contained everything. Not that contained only a part, as it were. Example. The third Beis HaMikdash, the third temple, is off limits to our understanding. For example, it says it will be built in fire. And its dimensions are not understood. It will be built in fire. What does that mean? It's a way of saying that it will be a specific thing, but it will be beyond the specific. Another example. Let's go back to another moment of breakdown. What was the original moment of breakdown? As far as we can talk about in this context, Adam. Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve. What was he before the sin, and what was he after? So everyone says that before the sin, he literally expanded, he stretched from heaven to earth. And he took in the whole world. It says he could see from one end of the world to the other. His feet were on the earth, and his head was, what does it mean? It means that he was a particular individual being, but he contained all of reality within him. It says the angels tried to worship him. And the sin caused the shrinking or the breakdown to his present. What kind of breakdown was it? The Gemara says that even after he sinned and died, one of the Tanoim went into his burial place in the Machpelah, where he's buried. And although he was allowed to look at the great figures who buried there, he was allowed to look at Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak, he was not allowed to look at Adam except his heels. Why the heels? Is because we know that the heel is the part of the body within which death resides. In other words, the lowest voltage, if you like, the least luminous or least incandescent part of the human being is the soul. The soul, the heel. The Gemara in one place says that Ein Rekev Ba'akev, that the heels do not rot after death, because they're dead already. The thick dead skin on the bottom of the feet, that's already. And therefore, the only place that was allowed to be, that our human eyes could see, was the part of Adam that was dead. More than that, the human being couldn't. And it says that after he had sinned and died, the light that shone from his heels darkened the sun. The light that shone from his heels was more potent than the sun. That's after he wasn't alive and after he'd fallen. So what was his luminescence before? So what do we see? We have a situation of an individual reality containing all of reality somehow beyond our comprehension. And the broken down situation. So the resolution is like this. That the Mishkan, the sanctuary, according to those opinions that say that there was a commandment to build it in the ideal, that's how it was meant to be. It was meant to be a focus and a manifestation of Hashem's presence on earth. That was not limited. But as a result, and that opinion's correct, but the other opinion's correct as well. As a result of the breakdown and the sin, it became a focus, but finite, limited, that the dimensions that it has now, and yet contains infinity within it. The two faces of the same. You find this in many expressions. Let me try and share with you one beautiful version of the notion. This is all very theoretical, very deep, abstract ideas. But we'll bring it down. Mitzvah, we'll bring it down to practical. We'll bring it down to practical application. There's a medrash that says, describing the process of this shrinking as an ideal, not as a breakdown, Both these themes run concurrently. The Medrash says like this. Listen to this amazing statement. When our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of a knife. When our love grew weak, a bed of 60 cubits was too small for us. And now that our love has grown weaker, Shamayim Kisi, the heavens are my throne, Va'aretz Hadoim Raglai, and the world is my footstool. The separation now is heaven and earth. What does the Medrash mean? The Medrash is talking in analogy, in mashal, about a young couple. Huh? Young couple. When they get married, to be put together on the blade of a knife is fine. When the relationship is strong at its moment of intensity, they can't be put together too closely. They can move into a place that has nothing, in which they cramp. The more cramped, the better. The blade of a knife. But after a couple of years, so then a bed of 60 cubits, what happens is he moves into the east wing and she moves into the west wing, and they still cross paths too often. And then a few years later, you know, heaven and earth are, you know, too close. That's not what we aim for, you understand? This is what the Medrash means here is that when our love was strong, the image of a love between husband and wife is always Hashem and us. Right? That's the Song of Songs. It's Hashem and us, the Jewish people, the young bride. When our love was strong, we lived in a Mishkan. We were able to live together on the blade of a knife. That little tent of meeting was tiny. Yes, when the intensity is strong, then the focus can be contained even more tight confines. But when we moved into the land of Israel, in which it's already a natural existence, not sustained miraculously, it's not eating man and having clothes that miraculously, that you're talking about plowing the land, and as a relatively speaking natural form of existence, what then housed this relationship? The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, was much bigger than the Mishkan in the desert. And by second temple times, when the love had already grown more distant as we go down in the descent of the generations, by that generation already the second temple was twice the size of the first and twice as empty. It contained no Shechinah anymore. The Gemara says that people who saw it, who had been alive during the first, wept when they saw the second. For its emptiness, grandness, but... And of course after that was destroyed, the relationship really is one of heaven and earth. Yeah, they don't have a focus anymore. That's the concept. What does this mean for us? Let's bring it down into practical. Let's bring it down to application. Let's see if we can begin to apply this. Stay with me carefully. In the original design of the world, you were not meant to be here. I was not meant to be here. Who was meant to be here was one human being who was universal, who was total, comprehensive. He was all things. He was the whole creation. He took it all in, he and she, in one fused being. Even the man and woman were one fused being. Not in our, again, the same sources say that Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, were fused at the back. There was no back. There was only two fronts. There was only oneness. The human being contained everything. But as a result of the breakdown, we arrived. What's the difference? And here comes the point that we need to begin to apply. That no one of us any longer is a universal neshama. Each of us is one piece of reality. And if you don't find out what piece is yours, you haven't started to live. You know, a man was once given a bucket of sand. And he was asked to carry the sand from here to there. And he spilled the sand. And the result was lots and lots of people had to come and each one carry one grain of sand. But in the end, the sand's going to get there. He failed, he spilled the bucket. And your job now is to carry one grain of sand, but you have to carry that grain of sand. And ultimately, it all has to get there, and your piece will be absolutely essential, but you have to find it and do it. That means that there's been a contraction down into individual parts, and that itself is its own correction, because by bringing your part out, and revealing the part that you have to do and what your role is and finding your identity and what you have to do, exactly where you have to fit. By bringing that out, you reconstruct the oneness. But you can't do it any other way. You can't maintain all of it within yourself. That's not your function. It's not what you're here for. But you have to hold within yourself what you have to hold. And then what happens is yours and mine combine, and then we melt into each other as that one supernal neshama. So that the result of the breakdown now is that you can't do it all. But that's its correction, because in making the effort to carry what you have to carry and allow me to carry mine, and you help me carry mine, I help you with yours. So we melt back into the oneness that we broke down. What does it mean in practical terms? That the sanctuary of the Jewish neshama, that Mishkan which lives in the heart of the Jew, is no longer that universal neshama. It's not that no longer that universal Mishkan that holds all of humanity and all of mankind and the purpose and tachlis of the whole. No longer that. It's now your personal individual neshama, and the sanctuary that has to be made within your heart is the discovery of the Kedusha, discovery of the holiness and the role that it is that you have to live. Because otherwise you don't have that sanctuary. On the contrary, if you haven't discovered yours, you've got an empty space. And if what you do is you're hankering after somebody else's, yeah, you have that issue of jealousy where you haven't begun to discover yours, but all you know for sure is you want his. So then you don't have an empty hole. You have a vacuum that sucks in all of reality. What does it mean in practical terms? Practical terms? Let me share with you some of the practical applications. You have to be well-rounded. You have to do all the mitzvahs. But there's one that you have to discover that's your special mitzvah. You know that? If you don't find that mitzvah that's yours, that speaks to you, there's a special resonance with your neshama, that's your speciality. Not only aren't you doing what you're meant to do here, but the whole thing's not running. Not working. The Talmud says, for example, I'll give you an example, there's a very interesting section in the Gemara where each of the sages comes along and states the reason for his having a share in the world to come. It's the Gemara in Shabbos towards the end. The Gemara says, each sage comes along and says, I'm guaranteed a share in the world to come because of tzitzis. Mitzvah of tzitzis, one mitzvah. I'm guaranteed a share in the world to come, one of them says, because it's three meals on Shabbos. One mitzvah. And there's a list of great sages there. You're not a share in the next world means, it doesn't only mean a reward. It means achieving the reality of what you... It means fulfilling, it means ultimate attainment of the depth and purpose of the neshama. And how do they express it? One mitzvah. Now there are many layers to this, of course. The Rambam says, and the Ramchal discusses it in detail, that it's possible to achieve a share in the world to come with one mitzvah done properly once in your life. Not just one department, but one occasion of mitzvah done once. And the quality is L'shem Shamayim. That means done for the next world. And the meaning of that is a long discussion in its own right, but the meaning is you have to invest there. If you do all the mitzvahs throughout your life because you think they make sense, or you do the mitzvahs throughout your whole life because you want to make a better world, the result is you'll make a better world, but you won't have any share there. Things grow where you plant them. If you don't plant your seed in a particular field, they're not going to grow in that field. Faith means, emunah means, that you do the mitzvahs that you do, but you invest. You know, the Rambam says if a non-Jew, wants a share in the world to come. So a non-Jew has a share in the world to come, but what are the requirements? The Rambam says if a non-Jew wants a share in the world to come, that non-Jew has to fulfill the mitzvahs of non-Jews that the Torah stipulates, and then he adds, he has to do them because it says so in a Torah that was given at Sinai. Why? Because if a non-Jew comes along and says that he wants to do the mitzvahs because they make sense and they will beautify the world, the result is they beautify the world. But that doesn't give you an eternal existence. But if a non-Jew comes along and says he's doing his mitzvahs because they have an ultimate source, because they come, they derive, they're a lifeline that's attached to an infinite source, so then he's doing them as an expression here of an infinite source and he's invested there. Same applies to a Jew. That means a very painful thing. If a Jew lives his whole life and every mitzvah is done only because of habit, because it makes sense, because he likes the idea, because it's traditional, no spiritual existence. Nothing. No share in the world to come. So Ramchal says he'll have a share. Ramchal says a very, very amazing expression. Ramchal says that if a Jew does mitzvahs for the wrong reasons, you're allowed to do mitzvahs for the wrong reasons, and they're valid. A Jew does mitzvahs for the reasons that are purely practical and time-bound and finite, says the Ramchal, he will have a share in the world to come for each mitzvah. You know why? And he uses amazing language. Because Hashem eino mekaper schar kol beria. Hashem does not withhold the reward of any creature. And therefore, you did the mitzvah, you were commanded and you did it, you'll have a share. But you know what those words mean? I heard one sage say that anyone who reads those words and doesn't either collapse or throw the book out the window, doesn't know what he read. Because those words have a source. And those words, Enum Kapel's Chalkol Beria, they appear in our sources in a very, very specific and interesting context. The origin of that phrase is that when the Jewish people went out of Egypt, the Egyptian dogs did not bark. No yechratz kelev meshoneh, no dog barked. And the Torah stipulates that because the dogs did not bark, they were given the reward that every non-kosher carcass is thrown to the dogs. Like kelev tashlichon, you should throw to the dogs. Why are the dogs rewarded with all the treif carcasses? Because Hashem eino mekapes chalkov, he doesn't withhold the reward of any creature. So the Torah says like this, that a dog, a hunt, that doesn't have any free will, that proverbially in Torah is the lowest of creatures, that has only chutzpah. The Mefarshim say a dog is that one creature thinks he's human. He thinks he's you. He thinks he's your friend. Because he didn't bark when the Jews went out of Egypt, he's given dead meat. So when the Ramchal comes and he uses that language, right, that if you do a mitzvah for the wrong reason, you'll have a reward. You know why? Because Hashem ana mekabeas chalkol b'riyah. Because just like those dogs that didn't bark were thrown dead meat, that's how you're going to be given a share in the world to come. That's a tremendous insult. That's the language that he uses. But a mitzvah has to be done. But there's much more here. It's not only that one mitzvah done once can open a share in the world to come because it opens the channel. There's another whole dimension. And that is, if that one mitzvah is you, then you've achieved your share because you've built yourself. Because that's what you were brought here to do that. You weren't brought here to do what he's meant to do or what she's meant to do. There was a time like that. That was called Adam. He was meant to do it all in one massive effort. But he broke down into you and me and him and her. And therefore the way to do that now is you and him and her and me. Each one has to do that piece that is part of the circuit, of the puzzle, of the letter in the Sefer Torah that makes the whole thing valid. Sefer Torah is no good if one letter is missing and another one doubled. The whole thing's invalid. One piece from an electric circuit missing, the lights don't come on. You want to put in two transistors because they're more valuable, and you want to take out one little piece of wire because it's worthless? Doesn't work that way. And ultimately it doesn't matter whether you're the little piece of wire that's worthless or you're the battery, because without either of those two pieces the whole thing doesn't work. And therefore, you have to start discovering what we call your yechidius, what makes you a yachid, what makes you that unique individual that you are. That's the beginning of religious development, of spiritual growth. That's the beginning of the path. So what's your mitzvah? What's your mitzvah? Which mitzvah speaks to you? Where is there that resonance? Is it stalker? Is it the things that are empathic between you and other people? What is it? If you don't begin to discover that, not only if you don't begin to discover it, you haven't begun to express yourself. The Gemara makes it clear that that's where you'll be held to account. The Gemara says in one place in Baba Metzia, one of the great sages happens to be the son of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, Rav Elazar bar Shimon. When he died, he was not buried. Gemara says he wasn't buried. They couldn't bury him in that place for certain reasons. And he lay in the attic of his wife's home for 18 years or 22 years, different opinions. He was not buried. Being a tzaddik, there was no decomposition. Right? We have a deep... No, this is not the time again to discuss it, but the body of a tzaddik does not decompose because the kedusha, the sanctity, has been devolved into the body itself. And therefore he lay perfectly. The Gemara says that after 18 years of lying in the attic, his wife used to go and see the body, that if a hair used to fall out of his head, it used to bleed. That was the degree of preservation. And after 18 years, a worm appeared on his ear. So she was very distressed. And it says he appeared to her in a dream. And he said, do not be distressed. The reason that a worm appeared on my ear is because I once heard a sage insulted and failed to defend him appropriately. The ear that once heard a Torah sage insulted and the response was not adequate, therefore that ear manifests an outer sign of decay. Now, there are none of the questions here. One of the questions is, there are many questions, but one of the fascinating questions is, why did it take 18 years? Why did it take 18 years before it happened? There are many questions. One of the reasons that it took 18 years is because you have a concept that in the next world there's a more serious and severe and refined and detailed judgment each year. The person has to answer for more and more refined things. If you had to answer for everything all at once, you wouldn't be able to take it. So there's a gentle process of more and more detailed assessment as time eventually arrived at a level where that degree of refinement was now being called into question. And that, why that manifestation? So the sages say, the commentaries say, because that was his specialty. That was his specialty. The one thing that he did uniquely and with near perfection was that he never allowed a Torah sage to be denigrated without the correct response. And therefore, once in his life when he did that, why? Because where you held accountable is where you were, and where you were average, you only held to an average standard. But where you excelled, you held to an excellent standard. And in the next world where you held to account is, what did you do? What did you do in terms of what you were supposed to do? What were your gifts? You were wealthy, you had money. What were your gifts? What do you know? How do you know what was your purpose? You look at your tools. In what age and generation were you born? In what family status? If you're an individual with tremendous problems and tremendous limitations, your job's easily mapped out. Let's say you're burdened by tremendous suffering. So your job's easy. All you have to do each day is one smile. That's all. One smile and one less complaint. If that's all you're capable of, it's easy to define. But let's say you have money, and you have two kidneys that function, and you have eyes that work, and you have too much sort of, you wake up in the morning and there's no specific pain. You have an immense responsibility. It's an immense set of tools, and an immense achievement is expected of you. But more than that, is an immense set of tools, an immense set of details in the constellation of factors that surround you. What is that unique expression that resonates with me more than anyone else that I have to go out and discover? In mitzvahs, there's one mitzvah that every Jew should polish and hone to perfection. You have to do all of them. But there's one that you'll be held accountable for because it was your star that you were meant to. In learning Torah, what is your particular joy in learning? There's an endless number of ways of learning Torah. There are people who choose to put more emphasis on the halachic, and there's people who put emphasis on the depth, and people on the more spiritual, and each of those has its own derech, and its own uniqueness, and its own flavor. There's aspects of Torah that only you can bring to the world, because only your mind would see them. Another person's mind would not see them. When you learn through a particular area, you make connections, you resonate, it comes out. A whole well of Torah wisdom is open from you, will never be open from anyone else. And if you haven't learned to the extent that that magnetic feeling, that magnetism is set up that brings your own Torah out into the world, you haven't done what you've been brought here to do. You'll be brought back. You'll have to do it some way. Because it has to be done. The sanctuary that has to be built in the neshama is a particulate and differentiated one. To make that holiness within you, you have to build that condensed and contracted microcosm of the world that is the part that you have to build. In each Jewish neshama is not the whole Mishkan. In each Jewish neshama is the Mishkan that is the uniqueness of that particular neshama. What's the difficulty? You know what the difficulty is? The difficulty is this, listen well. The side, the higher side, the side of your elevation that tempts you, again, you have to hear this very well, especially men. This is much more of a male, a true male problem. Whether men are really males these days is very doubtful. That the lowliness of the character, the negativity of the character, seeks to be all things, not to limit it down to the pettiness of just one. And you know where that yetzer is derived from? From your original, ultimate, all-encompassing spirituality. Where man originally was all things. So you have this incredible aspiration to be all and do all. And to become impatient with the pettiness of just this action and just this one and just this detail. And it reads out in many ways that the religious path, the spiritual path, is to become a cloned robot. I don't want to be one of those. The same uniform, the same thoughts, the same actions. That's the most fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be an observant Jew. The whole mechanism of being observant and of fulfilling every detail of every minute observance is to bring out the uniqueness of who you are. It's not to become a cloned robot of the next individual. That's exactly the opposite. People think, the secular mind thinks that I'm a hero because I carve out my own reality. But the religious individual is a cloned robot. But that's... You can be. You can be a groupie. Yeah, a cloned, groupie, robotic nobody. An observant. Just as you can be outside. But that's not the idea. The idea is to play your own music. With the same notes. That means you want to play the right notes, but you want to make your music. But that's what you're here for. So what's the problem? The problem is you want to be everything. And therefore there's a tremendous hesitation to bring it down to the thing that I have to be. And in Western society, especially in the male mode, and there's a very deep spiritual connection here, and that is because the male mode is totality. And the female mode is bringing it down and making it real and specific. The male is always the energy of multi-potential potentiality. And the female is the bringing down to that unique, contracted reality which has life. In all the biological world, in all mammals, seed is given by the male by the million and billion. And what meets that donation of millions and billion in the woman is only one. Only one. It's no accident. She's ultimately limiting that it's only this thing, but this becomes alive. That's what the female world is. The word nekeva in Hebrew, which means female, means fixing into a finite dimension. That's what it means. Nakva alai schachavet. Fix your wages and I'll pay you. Fix a wage. Give me a figure. That word means female. Because when you fix it, you limit it, but now it's real. Now it's in the world. It's that holy contraction which brings things down to the finite and the specific that allows them to live in the world. I'll never forget during the amazing experience of having to dissect a human embryo. I'll never forget. Unfortunately, no one explained it to me at the time. But later it became obvious. When you see the organs in that embryo that become the seed producing organs, right? The ovaries in a little girl, for example. Talk about a child who's still being formed within her own mother's womb. And you open up those ovaries. See, an amazing thing. You see a primordial tissue that becomes the factory of what will be seed. And you see in the male, those organs develop into factories that produce millions upon billions, countless. And in the woman, the same organs become organs that contain by the time, by the moment of birth, if you cut a section through that ovary, in a newborn girl, you can count every single one, and they're only enough that if she ovulates every one of those every month of her fertile life, she'll use every single last one. That's all. Same source, completely opposite differentiation. It's no accident. The maleness is the infinite potential, and the femaleness is the total finite contraction to the thing that can be real. The maleness is nothing without infinite potential. There are no women to make it real, it's nothing. And so the male mode seeks to be all things all at once, and will rather have the thrill of potential and never make it real. Male immaturity, and incidentally it's no accident that the youth phase of life tends to the male pole, and the older mature phase of life tends to the female. And youth and maleness is therefore given to the thrill of open potential. And maturity and femaleness is given to the pole of that which can be done, but making it happen. And so the immaturity is, I don't want to be only this or only that. And the real immaturity is, not only don't I only want to be this, but I specifically don't want to be the thing that's mine. That's boring. I want to be his. And not only his and his and his. And that's the immaturity. That's the immature mind. And that's the person who goes on vacation. And he wakes up in the morning at 6 in the morning. Amazing. He can climb the mountain, he can swim in the lake, and he can canoe on the river, and he can ride the horses. But only one of those. Only one of those. There's one day you can do only one of those. So the mature mind that tends to the female mode gets busy and goes and does one of them and enjoys it. The male mind frets and frustrates half the day in bed trying to figure out which one should be done, and then finally chooses one and is convinced that the worst possible option, all the others would have been better. Why? Where does this come from? This derives from the original nature of man, who was all things all at once, was that ultimate male potential. You know, we refer to Hashem always as male and the world always as female. That's not because we're not feminists. That's because the potential level of infinity is male. And the making it happen and making it real. Words like Adama and Eretz and Kelim and even stones, you know that? You know that a stone in Hebrew, which is the ultimate mystical building block of the world? Evan Shasia, right? The Evan Shtia from which the world is founded is a stone. The word Evan in Hebrew, there's nothing female about it at all, but it's a feminine word. In fact, the Medaktikim say that the word Evan in Hebrew spells Av and Ben coalesced. Father and son, which coalesce into one, and it's a female word. It happens in the mother. But it's a female concept. And therefore, the immature mind will rather have the thrill of potential energy and never do anything. You know that in Western culture, this is brought to a fine-tuned pitch. Is that what's valued is power, and not necessarily what the power can be brought down to doing. Think about it. What's money? You know what's money? You can't do anything with the money itself. What can you do? Eat it. Money is the potentiality for all the things that it can do. So the immature mind wants money. The mature mind wants money for what it can do. The immature mind wants money for the money's sake. And those people, by the way, they often don't spend. They often don't spend. They want money and they don't have enough. Because what they want is the potentiality. The purpose of the potentiality is to spend it for the genuine goods. As illustrated before, I'm sure we shared this idea together, but if you watch the immature mind, you watch a child outside a delicatessen. You watch a child who's got a coin in his grubby hand. And in the window, there are 25 different kinds of bun. It's an ecstatic child. He stands there for at least half an hour. He savors in his mind the taste of each one's unbelievable options. Finally, sooner or later, he has to make a choice. So the child finally chooses one, and he's about to hand his money over to the man for the bun when all 24 others start glowing brightly. And that's a miserable child, because no matter which one he has, he's absolutely convinced he bought the only tasteless one. You want to torture a child? You want to torture a child? It's not a specifically Jewish activity, but if you want to torture a child, you take a little child and you give him an ice cream. And when he's holding the ice cream, you give him another one. When the child's holding two ice creams, you offer him a third. And what the result will be, that is a pool of tears and ice cream on the floor, because the child can't understand. A child cannot understand that you can't have it all. You can only have what you can have, but have that and do it and sacrifice what must be sacrificed so that what you have can be. And the really immature mind will opt rather to have nothing but the fantasy of all the things that could have been. The genuine immature mind will prefer to lie in bed all day, fantasizing about all the things that could have been rather than get busy and do one and sacrifice the others. You know what is the happiness of the birth of a child? You know what is the real happiness of the birth of a child? It's an explosion of potentiality. It's a whole lifetime that can be lived. You know what's the sadness of old age? It's a closing down of potentialities. What can a very old person do? They can turn their chair a little closer to the sun, that's all. And ultimately, when even that goes and the end of life arrives, it's a closing down totally of all options, all potentialities. That's the happiness of the birth of a child, and that's the sadness of... But you know that in Jewish culture, in Jewish thinking, it's exactly the opposite. Do you know that in our minds, the birth of a child, for all its explosion of potential, is an anxious moment because nothing's been achieved yet. And in our minds, a very old person who's got not one bit of potentiality left, for all the sadness of the closed options, is the incredible joy of what's been done. In non-Jewish culture, you know, in Holland today, for example, one of the leading causes of death among the elderly is euthanasia. You know that they had themselves killed. It's well known. It's not officially legal, but it's sanctioned. Why? It's a very old person who can do nothing, cannot chase the options, cannot actualize the potential, cannot even dream of the potential. It's nothing to live for. It's an agonizing process. Every day of life that he spent is a deeper sadness. And in Jewish thinking, every day of life that is wisely spent, it will never come again. The currency has been given away, but the goods have been acquired. You know, that in non-Jewish culture, I'm not familiar with all languages on earth, but any culture or language I've ever been exposed to, youth is always described as springtime and summer. And old age is always described as winter. You know, in Torah, it's exactly the opposite. You know that? In Torah, we refer to youth as winter. King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, talks about Yimei Chorfi, the days of my winter, the days of my youth. And old age we describe as summer. Why? Because the genuine view is that winter is when they break the hard ground and they put the seeds in. And summer is when you reap the crop. But that's a genuine view of life. If you live a life like that, Where what's happening is potentiality is being sacrificed. Every day that goes will never come again. You know what a dying man would give for one more day? Anything. How can you kill a day? How can you kill a day? A day fantasizing about what might have been done is a day killed. That's an element of suicide. But a person has taken a day and they've sacrificed all the 999 options to do the one that could be done that day. So the potentiality has been gone. Sacrifice can never be done. The 999 other people have to do those things. But the one thing that you could do has been done now. That will never disappear. So as you move on towards summer, there's a crop that's waiting to be reaped. But it's only when you discover the uniqueness of what the one out of the thousand that you had to be doing. And therefore, the work is the work of defining individuality. It's knowing that this process of building the Mishkan, among many other messages. A few weeks ago we shared the concept of Shabbos, being inherent in the building of the Mishkan. Can you hear how these two have a confluence? We said Shabbos is the definition of endpoint. That's the ultimate summer where the crop is focus of everything that's been built, everything that's been exported and stored in the world of reality. So that's inherent in the Mishkan. Can you see where these ideas are? That's where the togetherness of the human in his or her particulate and differentiated manifestation is living in one bond with that universal manifestation. That Mishkan is the place where the particular and the universal meet, and where they blend, and they blend into that universal oneness. Not because the human being living there tries to expand to embrace the universe, but because the human being living at that point and building his own or her own Mishkan within his or her own neshama is an individual who has learned how to marry together the male and female components of his or her own neshama and to discover that incredible potential that is each human being that does speak of universal oneness and achievement, but has learned how to bring it down to the piece that he has to be, or she has to be. And instead of the immaturity of hankering after being everything all at once, and in fact turning out to be nothing, what's demanded here is the work of learning the wisdom of allowing that feminine world of limitation to bring down the world of potential into the world of the actual so that it can be built and realized and actualized. Thank you.